good to be back with you one more time to talk about some Old Testament materials. This week we're concentrating on matters related to God's relationship to nature. And today we're going to take a look at Genesis 1 primarily. Tomorrow we're going to talk a little bit about God and calico cats. And we'll start with Psalm 139 and move on from there. And then Thursday, Job 38 to 41 on God's taking Job to the zoo. And then finally on Friday, Psalm 148 and all those non-human sopranos and tenors. Probably a few basses in there too. So today, I'm for the bookstore. I'm supposed to lift this up and let you know that this is in the bookstore. I wrote a book 3 years ago or so. How long has it been? The Suffering of God, an Old Testament perspective, where some of these matters related to, not the stuff that we're doing this week, but other matters related to images for God and their importance for faith and life, book published by Fortress Press. Then I got a care package from my wife, who was supposed to be here with me, but is busy in the office of... She's director of the literacy program for the Women's Organization of the New Lutheran Church. And she sent me along some bookmarks with advertising the impact of the importance of the literacy program of the Women's Organization. So if some of you want a bookmark, you're welcome to have one of those. Now I can go back and tell her that I've done that. You've heard about it. Here it I suppose when you take a look at the first chapter of Genesis, and as you rely on your memory with respect to those verses, there's a sense in which it's sort of old hat. You've heard this story many, many times. Those 7 days of creation, and you probably could almost recite from memory what happened on each of the days. At least you know that the human beings were created on day six. And It's become such a familiar story that it often flows right over us without hooking us in any way anymore. Or another way to put that is that the image of God as creator, which is present in this chapter, has become a rather tired image, maybe even an exhausted image for us, and so that it doesn't have a kind of impact on our minds. What does it mean to speak of God as creator? We're too used to that language for it to have the kind of impact it ought to have anymore. So we need to resurrect, if you will, to renovate this image. And one of the ways in which I'm suggesting that we do that is to take a look at some verses in this chapter that we've not attended to very well over the years. I suspect that if I were to go around the room and ask you what do you think about the God that's present in chapter 1 of Genesis? We'd hear something like, well, all-powerful God, you know, speaks the word, poof, and everything comes into being, and everything's sort of all put in order and in place, and nothing's missing. Everything's all exactly the way in which it ought to be. And then we've got this 7-day sequence, too, you know. I mean, it's God does all of this in just 7 days. And by the way, it is 7 days. He doesn't finish, you recall. Chapter 2, verse 2 says he didn't finish it until the seventh day. So you've got to reckon with that a little bit. But it takes just that amount of time to finish all of this work. And I think there's no way that... sure, you can argue it, but... I think that these are 7 24-hour days. I don't think there's really much you can do about that to try to read days in terms of ages or make days symbolic somehow. I think it's just 7 24-hour days. It's interesting, the Gerhard von Rad, who's one of the most noted commentators, Lutheran commentator on Genesis, has this very explicit statement. He says, the 7 days of creation are unquestionably to be understood as actual days and as a unique, unrepeatable lapse of time in the world. I mean, you can't get more direct than that. 7 24-hour days, that's what we've got to deal with here. And the impact of that is that God does this quickly, and it's an awful lot to accomplish in that short period of time. I think the 7 days are 24-hour days for a variety of reasons. One is day in the Old Testament has its normal meaning, day, wherever it's used many, many times. It talks about evening and morning in the chapter. You talk about evening and morning in terms of 24-hour periods. You've got the 6 days of work and the 1 day of rest, and then you get into the commandments in Exodus 20 and says, just as God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh day, so you too are to work for 6 days and rest on the seventh day. And wherever this material comes up, you're talking in terms of actual days. Now, what are you going to do with that? That's another question, but I think the text says that. And anyway, the impact of this kind of material and this way of looking at the text, and I think a general understanding of Genesis 1 is, here is an all-powerful God that brings this world into being in perfect shape, boom, just like that. Now, let's take a look at some verses that give push or pull that image of God in just a little bit different direction. One hesitates very much to use the word scientific for anything that goes on in Genesis because of the misuse to which the language of science has been put by some groups. But it is true to say, I think, that the ancient Hebrews were very interested in matters relating to the natural order. And they've been about the business of ordering plants and animals and probing into this or that as best they could with the tools that they had. And so they had certain basic, quote, scientific understandings of the world of which they were a part. I think by taking a closer look at a couple of them in this chapter, we might uncover some different angles of vision. Take a look at verse 11. Verse 11 and 12, you've got some interesting comments about the ordering of plants and so forth. You've got plants yielding seed and fruit trees bearing fruit, and which is their seed. You can see how they've begun to observe the world around them and began to categorize some of that. But notice what God says in verse 11. And God said, let the earth put forth vegetation. And verse 12, the earth brought forth vegetation. God's creation here is not direct. It's indirect. The earth is what brings forth the vegetation. So it's not God creating something immediately. Boom, there it is. God works through the earth to bring forth vegetation. So the creation is not immediate, it's mediate. Or look at verse 20. And God said, let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures. Again, waters used as the means by which a certain aspect or parts of the creation are brought into being. Look at verse 24. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds. Again, the earth used as a vehicle for the creative activity of God. God doesn't create directly. He uses certain already existent aspects of the created order in and through which to create additional aspects of the creation of the created order. Now, that's very important because what it does is it indicates that God makes use of that which is already created to bring into being that which is not yet created. God doesn't do everything all by himself. The image of God as creator is then, it's important, that God doesn't do everything as creator by God's self. God uses other aspects of the created order to bring into being, to create. Sometimes people use the word, interpret the language of create in a little different way than I do here. The very first verse, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. In this chapter you'll notice that there's the language of create and there's the language of make. Look at verses 6 and 7. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament. In the first chapter of Genesis, you'll find an interweaving of the language of create and the language of make. Now, the language of create in the Old Testament is used only with God as the subject. The language of make is commonly used with human beings as the subject. But sometimes people, in interpreting this chapter, lift up the word create and say, aha, God creates. And there's no human analogy to that, folks. I mean, God does something absolutely unique here. Oh, no, just wait a minute. There's all kinds of uses of the word make in this chapter, too. And that word is used of human beings. One can talk about human analogy there. So that in the language of creation and creating and making, you find God's activity. God initiates this activity. God plays a role that human beings or other aspects of the created order cannot finally play. But the use of the word make indicates that the activity of human beings has some analogy to the activity of God here. Human beings can also bring into being, can create, can make. So that's another feature of this chapter that is important. Still another feature is the language of speaking and making. God said, and God said, and God said. God speaks, and apparently it comes into being, sort of like magic. Poof! But that's not what the text says. What does the text say? Look again at verses 6 and 7. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. But that's not enough. It's not just God speaking and it comes into being. It goes on to say, and God made. So there's the combination of speaking and making. Or look down in verses 14, the saving work of God. And to oversimplify, God's saving work has to do with those specific acts of deliverance, like saving the people from from Egypt by crossing the Red Sea. But blessing has to do with God's continuous sort of unobtrusive flowing activity in the rhythms and the processes of life. And a text like Deuteronomy 33 would lift up that sort of divine activity. Deuteronomy 33, beginning with verse 13. And of Joseph he said, blessed by the Lord, 33:13, blessed by the Lord be his land, with the choicest gifts of heaven above, and of the deep that couches beneath, the choicest fruits of the sun, and the rich yield of the months, and the finest produce of the ancient mountains, and the abundance of the everlasting hills, and the best gifts of the earth in its fullness. That sort of blessing talk. The God's fertile activity, if you might say, in all of the nooks and crannies of the universe. I think that this work on Festival's part is really very important, because what it does is it shows God's continuing creative activity in the life of the world. And in more hidden, unobtrusive ways, we tend to emphasize sort of those big dramatic events of God so much. And here we see God at work in these flowing ways. And I should say here that this raises some interesting masculine-feminine issues with regard to God's activity in the world. While Westermann is clearly a male scholar, he's this emphasis upon, if you have emphasis upon the dramatic, God's dramatic activity in the life of the world, if you read through scholars, particularly Old Testament scholars' understanding of God's activity in the Old Testament, it tends to be dramatic, it tends to be intrusive, it tends to be interventionist. God's always intervening to do this and intervening to do that. That's masculine imagery for God's activity in the world. If you move to blessing, that's more feminine imagery, and so images of fertility, of sustaining, of nourishing, of embracing, of bringing to life, of birthing, that's blessing activity. And so to keep the blessing activity and the saving activity working together brings masculine and feminine imagery working together in ways that has not been as common in the life of the church as might have been the case. So God continues to create. God doesn't do everything just at the beginning of things. Now, Genesis 1, let me work through a little bit in Genesis 1:26 following, and then let's open it up and talk about it a little bit. verse 22. The first speaking that God does in the Genesis story is not to human beings, but to animals. Verse 22, and God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas. Interesting, we'll come back to that a little bit more tomorrow, this theme of God's relationship to the animal world. But then go down to verse 26. Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. Let them have dominion. Come back to that. So God created man in his own image, and the image of God created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Notice that the same language is given to the human beings that's given to the animals. To be fruitful and multiply. And verse 22 is over against verse 28. Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and have dominion. There you are again, over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. Now, let me just back up for a moment. Here, God speaks words to the human, newly created human beings that are power-sharing words. That's one way of looking at it. It's a power-sharing word. Let them have dominion. I'm not going to keep it all for myself. Let them have power. That's an extraordinary act of God when you think about it. God determines not to keep all power to himself. Why? Think a little bit about relationship. We use the language of relationship a lot when we talk about God and human beings, God and the animal world for that matter. God, we say we have a relationship with God. What does it mean to have a relationship? What does it mean for a relationship to be real?
Sharing,
mutuality, trust. Is it possible to have a true relationship if one party of the relationship has got all the power? You ever know of a good relationship between two persons where one person's got all the power? Not in your life. God knows what it takes to have a true relationship. It means that God cannot keep all the power. God must share some of the power in order for there to be a relationship which is real. And that happens, boom, right off the bat. In the opening chapter of Genesis, as God chooses to give up power for the sake of relationship. God has chosen not to do everything in the world all by himself. Now, one can get prayer involved in this. What does it mean to have a relationship where only one part of the relationship has anything important to say? That's not a relationship of any consequence. So God gives the gift of prayer, and the purpose of the gift of prayer is so that the other part of the relationship can have something important to say in the relationship. So here now, too, with issues of power, God chooses to share power with the creature rather than keep it all God's self. Now, that's an amazing risk. That's a risky move. Because if God chooses to share power, God opens up the possibility that the ones with whom God has shared power might misuse it, might abuse it. And then instead of a power-sharing situation, you got a power-clashing situation, and the creature then has chosen to misuse that. But God, for the sake of relationship, takes that risk. You all know that the more you share of yourself in a relationship, the more vulnerable you become. The more risky, the more risk you take in that relationship. Well, here, right off the bat in the creation story, God takes an amazing risk by giving up some power and freedom and giving it over to the creature for the sake of a relationship. And so the impact of that in the creation story is you get this overwhelming, all-powerful God who brings all of us into being and then gives it away for the sake of a relationship with that which has been created. And for the rest of the Bible, you've got to read the Bible through the eyes of that relationship that's now been established, where God has chosen to give something up for the sake of a real relationship. Now, what is this power that people have been given? And not simply people here, but also you get this word to the non-human. Generally speaking, in the biblical material tends to steer clear of deism on the one hand and determinism on the other hand when it comes to the natural order or relation. On the one hand, deism, that's to say, where God sort of creates the world, winds it all up, and then lets it go like a clock. From the Old Testament perspective, God continues to care for the world and be attentive to the world, and so in certain passages you can talk about God bringing the rain and God making the grass grow, and you get interesting passages like that. On the other hand, you don't have determinism, that is to say, you don't have everything being done by God. God doesn't do everything. God is not absolute monarch. God chooses to allow other parts of the creation to be involved in their own given activity. And so you'll find that in certain passages that the ground brings forth grass, or the heavens bring forth rain. And so you have to steer between God not doing anything and God doing everything, in a kind of dual agency role of where God continues to be involved, God doesn't let it go, but at the same time God gives to the creature the ability to work, to generate, to bring into being, and so forth. And that's a tricky business, to try to keep that road between God not doing anything and God doing everything. But in these passages now, then, we get God giving to the creation, to the creature, this task of dominion. Let me give you a little book I understand they have in the bookstore, a fine book by Douglas John Hall entitled Imaging God. He's also got a new book entitled God and Human Suffering, which is very helpful, but the one that pertains here, Imaging God, and it's subtitled Dominion as Stewardship. Dominion as Stewardship. In which he points out that this language of dominion is not a language of exploitation. It's commonly been used, I think, in the history of humankind to talk about sort of exploiting the earth, making use of the earth for human benefit only. But dominion, its basic meaning in the Old Testament is that it means to care for, to tend to be concerned with. And that's the image that is to lie behind our understanding of dominion here. So, there's a significant amount of indeterminacy built into the created order of things. If the creature, having been given power now to have dominion, misuses that power, the creation can be all messed up. On the other hand, the creature is given power to care for the earth. And if on the positive side, the creature working together with God can bring the creation to a finer, toward perfection, building on what God has initially done, can bring it in a more positive direction. Rather than a negative. What human beings do with the power that they have can bring the creation one way or another. And you know as well as I do that the human beings have gone a couple of ways on that one. No doubt much human effort has contributed to the care of the earth. but much human effort has also gone the other way. And let me, the church commonly, the church sort of brings up the rear on so many issues that are generated by the culture generally. And so ecology, and the church is on board now with regard to ecological matters pretty well. But if they had paid attention to the Old Testament, if the church had been paying attention to the Old Testament all through these years, they would have been in the forefront of that discussion rather than bringing up the rear. And let me give you one text among many that could be cited that I think is such a powerful text that indicates what in fact has happened to the earth because of human misuse, and that's Hosea chapter 4. Hosea is the first of those 12 minor prophets. Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, or the end of the Old Testament. You'd swear that some of these texts were written in an era of acid rain or whatever, but they aren't. Beginning chapter 4 of Hosea, beginning with verse 1. Hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel, for the Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land. The Lord has a controversy. That's a strong language. There's no faithfulness or kindness. There's no knowledge of God in the land. There's swearing, there's lying, killing, stealing, committed adultery. They break all bounds, and murder follows murder. Therefore, what happens? The land mourns. Now, isn't that doesn't seem right to put those two words together for us. But the land mourns. And all who dwell in it languish. And also the beasts of the field and the birds of the air and even the fish of the sea are taken away. Human misuse of power, human abuse of power that they've been given results in this cosmic disorder. And the creation begins to deteriorate, because human beings have not assumed the kind of dominion they ought to have assumed. So, let me say a final paragraph here and open it up. While God's activity is effective, there's a significant element of indeterminacy, that God has chosen not to do everything in the world all by himself. God has chosen not to have full control of things. Now that might be a little disconcerting. Now things are not out of control, but God has chosen not to have full control of things. God has given the creatures power. Reminds me a little bit of that. I've got a colleague whose illustration of God is in control. Came back from visiting an intern one night late, came up behind a car that was weaving all over the road. The driver was obviously drunk as a hoot owl. He came up close and there was a bumper sticker that said, God is in control. But God has chosen not to be in control. God has chosen to give creatures power, with all the risks that entails. And God's possibilities in the world are thereby limited. What God can do in the world is limited because God now has to come to terms with that other power center that's in the world. While God always aims for the best in every situation, God must often settle for that which is less than good. And you know as well as I do that in God working through you and me, God often has to settle for that which is less than best. God cannot do, now it's hard to say that Lord language, God cannot do what would have been possible if God had chosen to keep all power to himself. So God now opens up the world to others for their care, for their concern, for their tilling, for their keeping, so that the language of goodness can not only continue to be used for the world, but that that goodness can even be enhanced and improved upon. Sometimes we use the terrible word self-sufficient for God. God is not self-sufficient. God has chosen to be dependent upon you and me and others in carrying out certain tasks in this world. And that's scary because it lays a heavy responsibility on us. But what a God we have who has chosen to venture forth with this creation, with those kinds of risks for the sake of a relationship that's genuine, that's real. Well, let's open it up and talk about it.
What's the, is it the obvious distinction that when God goes from 14 where, maybe back up a little bit, where the earth gives the vegetation, and then the waters bring forth the birds and that's interesting, isn't it? The waters give the birds, and the waters also give the fish. That then there, and the earth again gives the cattle, but it isn't the earth and it isn't the water that gives humanity. It's God. Is that just the obvious thing there?
But it also happens at the beginning with regard to firmament, for example. There's not, the firmament is created in ways similar to humanity. It's not the earth or the waters are not used as a medium in and through which God creates. So there's both direct creation in Genesis 1 and there's indirect creation, immediate and immediate. So you have both here. But what I think what the common perception is, you know, is that you just got direct creation,
yeah,
or immediate creation, and you've got a combination. To extend that in terms of continuing creation, one can talk about God's continuing work, taking the initiative, directly creating, and one can talk then about indirect, God using the creature, including the human, then in and through which to create.
Is there any idea that there's more stability to the fact that God did the firmament and humanity, whereas the earth and the waters did the vegetation and other animals? Is there any hint to that?
One could perhaps say, I've not asked the question quite that way, Bob, but one could perhaps say that the sort of the greater stabilities in the universe, you know, the heavenly bodies, the existence of the human, the firmament, which is the sky, that those are more the continuities.
Okay.
Whereas some of the others, there's more sort of more movement there, more change there over time, possible. Yes, Mark.
Can you say something about this, the light? On day one, there's creation of the light and the separation of light and darkness. And then day four, we get the sun. How does, in terms of the human mentality, how did that work? I mean, what did they think?
Put yourself back into that age if possible. And where do you think light comes from on cloudy days?
Fire.
I mean, there's no sun. Or before the sun comes up in the morning or after it goes down at night, there's still light around, right? And I think that what's going on there is that the Hebrews believed that there was a source of light other than the heavenly bodies. And that the heavenly bodies in their creation really function in two ways. You'll notice that the language of the heavenly bodies is to rule the day, rule the day, to rule the night, I think a light supplement, perhaps, as well as the times and seasons kinds of concerns there. That's present. That's how I would bring them together. There is a source of light, which then is other than heavenly bodies, but then is supplemented. Yes?
I was a little confused. Early on, were you saying that from the knowledge that the Hebrews had of science at that time that they truly thought that the earth was created in 7 days?
Yeah, I think they probably did.
Yeah.
I mean, can't be absolutely sure, but all the evidence in the text suggests that 7 24-hour days. It's kind of interesting. With our high view of the scriptures, we often engage in what I call a harmonization syndrome. If we run into something that doesn't quite correspond to the way we think about things, we try to work with it enough so that it will finally harmonize, with the way in which we think. And so it's kind of interesting to watch the interpretation of the days in Genesis ever since, science has begun to show that the earth is much older than the scriptures suggest. And so you get the days interpreted in terms of evolutionary periods and that kind of thing. But I think that's just that's wreaking havoc with the text. Let the text be an ancient text with regard to these matters and just say, well, we can't go along with the Bible at this point. I'm sorry. I mean, our understanding of the universe is a little bit different than that. But they used the knowledge of their time in and through which to talk about God as creator. We can still make the great affirmation that God is the creator of the world. God is the creator of you and me, regardless of the sort of the scientific matters or information that we might have as the sort of the framework in which to talk about God as creator. Sammy?
Could you say something about the period in history when Genesis was to have been written? It seems to me that I remember a class by Ralph Klein that put the writing of Genesis within the Babylonian captivity or at that time, and that, the story, the actual story that is written in Genesis reflects the poetry, the belief of the Hebrews at that time. I think we're not ever quite sure when was Genesis written, who suddenly threw this book out. And I think for me that was a very helpful thing, and I can't remember just what it was, and if you have anything to add to that.
It's commonly suggested that Genesis 1 is written in the 6th century and Genesis 2 perhaps in the 10th century, and that a later editor brought them together and wove one story out of it. One of the ways in which you get the Babylonian Israel in the 6th century was in exile in Babylon. One of the ways in which you get the Babylonian context coming out in this chapter, there's some polemics here, is the way in which they name the heavenly bodies. Look at verse 16, 17, 16 primarily. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And oh, by the way, he made the stars too. Now, interesting, what's not there? The sun isn't named. And the moon isn't named. It's just the greater light. No, they knew it. I mean, it's all over the Old Testament elsewhere. It's sun and moon. They know names for those things. And the stars get a kind of subordinate clause at the end of the sentence. And the suggestion is that that's anti-astrological. Is that in the Babylonian context to which the text is written, you have worship of the heavenly bodies, including the stars. And the author takes them down a notch or two by not even bothering to name them, and then just tacks on the stars as an afterthought, almost. So that's that context does contribute to some polemics, perhaps more than any other. There are some parallels between the creation stories in Genesis and creation stories in Babylon and in other parts of the ancient Near East. It's clear that Israel wasn't the first to think about creation or our God is one who created the world, and so you do they pick up ideas from their cultures and make use of them to convey to tell these stories. And that's, it's helpful to see that as a part of the context, certainly.
mentioned the two polarities of deism and determinism. Do we have a God that intervenes then, someplace in between those two?
Oh my, what a big subject. Tomorrow we're going to talk a little bit in connection, maybe we could reserve some of this for tomorrow. We'll talk a little about the fact that God's present everywhere in the universe. And God is active in every event and present on every occasion. God is involved in everything. And if God is involved in everything, then one would think that if God's there, God can get done whatever God wants to get done. But what we've had to talk about in Genesis 1 is that God's decided to move with the world in a little different way and share power rather than keep all power himself. And God, I think, is involved in all of these occasions and all of these events in such a way as to not violate the relationship that's been established, in such a way as to not violate the integrity of the creatures that have been brought into being. So, for example, with regard, I mean, you get a kind of mythological understanding of the natural order in some formulations. Well, God today pushed the rain clouds just a little south of Albert Lee, you know, and then, you know, he won't. But the rain falls on the just and the unjust. So God has chosen to be involved in everything, but not in an all-determining fashion, allowing for the integrity of the creatures and the integrity of the relationship. And so I think the language of intervention is decidedly unhelpful. Maybe, I don't know, we ought to follow up a little bit on that. When could get going here at some length?
From the perspective of a God that has put something in motion, yet individually where we hit crises, does he intervene? Does he change what he's put into motion?
God,
he had control.
God, I don't think God is God has the kind of control that we often claim. God always works for the best in every situation. I was always working for the best. But there are some situations where God has to be satisfied finally with much less than the best, simply because of the possibilities that are inherent in a given situation. If I get my leg cut off that's God can't make my leg go back. That would violate the integrity of the created order of things. I mean, that's an extreme example, but the one has to extrapolate from that and kind of work in a variety of contexts to talk about God's presence and activities in comparable ways. I think it's a very big subject. I hope we can address it a little bit more tomorrow when we talk about God's presence. Yes, sir?
One of the images that has been helpful to me is to distinguish between being in charge and being in control. As a parent, I'm in charge of my children.
Mm-hmm.
All too often, I'm not in control. and I wonder if that can be a problem.
Yeah, that's helpful. How about somebody you like that? That's in charge but not in control. And perhaps in being in, the only suggestion there that would be a little tough for me would be that we're not children in God's eyes, we're adults. And hence, we probably make decisions for our children that we won't make for them when they're adults, obviously. And I think there is an adulthood that's assumed, I think, when God establishes his relationship. So there would be some important distinctions to draw at that point in the analogy, but I like your language. I think it's helpful.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm reminded of something, of Raphael Sayer's book, The Mind of the Maker, which is a bit brief, but it seems to me that, and it's been a long time since I've read it, but it seems to me that she makes a distinction between, as you began with, between creating and making, in that, and tries to make those mesh Trinitarian language, that there's the idea, and then there's the incarnational work, and then there's the effect, and in effect, that's the spirit that lets it go and does not seek to have control over what it does, mm-hmm. so that you can't control what people's reaction is going to be towards a given thing, and then if God is in conversation with us, we'll take into account those reactions.
I think you're pushing along lines that I'd like to think in comparable ways. The language of letting go is a phrase that's used in some circles that's a little bit problematic for me, because it suggests deism. It suggests that God just lets it go.
Well, lets it go in the and not to control the other for the response.
Yeah, I would want to if you can build in. Language like continuing care for, continuing working for the best for, God continuing to be involved in everything.
Yeah.
If you can build in that kind of language to letting go, but it's a little bit.
I was thinking, Raphael Sayer's concern, I think, is also one of an artist who tries to see the work of an artist in a similar way as the work of God.
Yeah, the difficulty with the artist parallel is that the artist, once the work is on canvas, to use Painter as an example, once the work's on canvas or once the words are in the book, that creative work is out of the control of the artist in a way different from God's relationship to creation. I mean, there's some helpful analogies there, but there are some points at which it's not helpful.
But there's always more to be created. There's more canvas.
Oh, sure, yes. But God is God continues to be involved in every aspect of the continuing life of that which is created. God doesn't let it go into the world on its own, as it were. Sammy.
Yeah, I really am so grateful for this session. It's just made a lot of sense to me because, you know, you have questions about free will and all of that. And that whole relational aspect of God and humanity is really a beautiful thing. And it fits so wonderfully with what we've been talking about on Rainbow on the Mountaintop, about other races and other worlds, how we do have a responsibility because we have been designated as co-creators with God and co-responsibility people. And when anything is violated, people or the creation or the world, anything, we need to keep our ears and eyes open and say, where do I fit into that healing process?
Yeah.
And
I think
you know, with South Africa and Central America, the folks say, that'll take its course. We need that to happen. And let's pull back from that. That's not part of our responsibility. And this has been very, very helpful for me.
Or another example that comes to mind is, say the nuclear stuff.
Right.
I mean, how many times have I heard, don't bother to do anything about the nuclear issue. On the one hand, if God wants to use the nuclear issue as a way of bringing the world to an end, what can we do about it? And if God doesn't want the world to end by nuclear holocaust, God won't let it happen.
Right.
I mean, and I think both of those directions simply don't take into account this very concern of the responsibility that we've been given. I do have a touch problem with the language of co-creator. I'll use it myself. But the language of co-creator suggests that that God and the human party, or God and the creature, because I think non-humans are also involved in the creative activity, but are sort of on an equal plane here and are equally involved in all aspects of creative activity. And I have some difficulty with the sort of equality issue at that point.
Yeah.
And I read the eighth day of creation, people. We talked a little bit about that. I think it's certainly a helpful emphasis in terms of the involvement of the creature in continuing creative activity. The eighth day language bothers me a touch. I understand the purpose of using that language, but what the Genesis material is suggesting is not an eighth day of creation, but it's suggesting that human creative activity follow the divine creative activity. It's kind of divine creative activity becomes paradigmatic, so that 6 days of work and 1 day of rest then become a kind of rhythm for human creative activity. It's just a different mode.
How would you brush in the wasn't it the parable of the three stewards we had the other night in the gospel? And the one guy was scared and dug a hole and stuck it in. How do those three guys fit in with this creation thing? I mean, in the light of equality and co-creation, I'd be the guy with the pound and stick in the ground. I'd be scared.
Let's talk about that with you, Bob. Let's just.
Turn that one around, and the guy who dug it and stuck it in the ground.
Certainly, some of those stewardship parables pertain here. I mean, what are you going to use with the gifts that you've been given? But it's even more in the creation text. It's not only, you know, it's a sort of gifts in the larger sense of the gift of the world, not just the gift of some money or whatever. What are you going to do with the world which is yours? What stewardship are you going to apply? So certainly there are some important connections there. But oftentimes we're able to treat gifts we've been given on an individual basis. You know, what are you going to do with that which is individually mine? But right now we're dealing with the world, which is everybody's, and we have an individual role to play so that the world is kept for those who are not ourselves.
Good distinction.
Thank you. Thank you. Tomorrow we got God and Calico Cats. So we'll look forward to seeing you. Thank you.